Big Ideas presents Senator Hugh Siegel on why we need a new national approach to tackling poverty. His lecture, entitled Fighting Poverty, was produced in collaboration with the Literary Review of Canada and was delivered at the Gardner Museum in Toronto on November 12, 2012. Big Ideas is a TVO production. For more information, visit tvo.org.
Friends, I want you to imagine for a moment that you're a recently trained and certified trauma nurse working in a large emergency ward somewhere in Canada. An ambulance rolls in with a young injured patient, is wheeled quickly into the main trauma bay. You see where the bleeding is and are eager to engage and stop it as colleagues do an instant and hopeful assessment of the patient's vital signs. As you proceed to gather the material necessary for the physician and nurse in charge, they stop you. Don't you think we should first find out what the patient's nutrition standard has been for the last few years and the kind of housing they have, one asks? And what about their parents, their work-life balance, and how the patient did in school, asks another. You are dumbfounded because you just want to stop the bleeding first. Stabilize the patient. And what if there were 800 rules that defined whether you could or could not treat the bleeding first? Because you are, after all, spending public funds. And when you finally actually are allowed to stop the bleeding, the doctor in charge warns you not to clean or disinfect the entire long cut, just half. And he would only suture that half. When you asked why, his response was, because that's the policy set by provincial governments all across Canada. We are, after all, spending taxpayers' dollars. This would strike any thinking Canadian as absolutely absurd and never, ever likely to happen. Yet that is exactly how we deal with poverty. And just as the senior doctor and nurse were well-meaning in their question and inquiries, they were evading the core issue. The patient was still bleeding. And welfare rates in most provinces, as we stand here tonight, are well beneath the low-income cutoff for all Canadians. In other words, not enough upon which to live, however modestly. This is how we deal with poverty in almost all parts of Canada. Let's think about how we handle poverty for everyone except our senior citizens. Our federal governments and provincial governments have argued for decades that poverty is a complex problem. Complex is one of those words they just adore. Poverty is a complex issue, to be sure, but in the beginning and in the end, it's about one thing: people not having enough money to meet basic needs such as food, shelter, clothing, and transportation. Everything else is a detail. Who are the people living beneath the poverty line? How many are there in urban Canada or in rural Canada or among our First Nations or fellow citizens who have just arrived and were lawful immigrants? The overall poverty level in Canada has changed little over the past 35 years. It has improved for some demographic segments of the population, but by and large, not very much. It was 12.9% in the mid-70s, 12% in the late 1900s. And according to the OECD numbers, Canada ranks, wait for it, 18th, behind France, Norway, Austria, Finland, Sweden, Germany, Ireland, Switzerland, Belgium, Denmark, Hungary, and the Czech Republic, who all have poverty rates much lower than ours. The recently released Poverty Trends Scorecard, published by Citizens for Public Justice, has analyzed the poverty trends between 1981 and 2010. And as I said, there has been progress in some areas. For the vast majority of single seniors, mostly women, the poverty rate across Canada was 49.7% in 81. In 2010, this number had dropped to 14.3%, genuine progress. But for other groups, recent immigrants, for example, in 81, the poverty rate was 12.6%, compared to 17.6% in 2010. Those numbers are going in the wrong direction. Single individuals under the age of 65 have made no progress in over 30 years. None. Zero. Nada. Rien. Garnished. Zip. None. 3 in 10 were poor in 1981. 3 in 10 were poor in 2010. And are twice as likely to be poor than single individuals over the age of 65. So the question we should ask ourselves as rational people is, why do we avoid the direct issue of simply topping up people over the poverty line? The complexity argument is one often used. Poverty is complex, you hear. There are too many factors in play. It's intergenerational. It's impossible to address all the root causes of poverty. So in the end, it's far easier to spend money on a myriad of terribly expensive programs that may, quote, help, quote, reduce poverty without actually dealing with poverty straight on. Help, by the way, is one of those weasel words that make it clear that the government's du jour of any political affiliation would rather help to reduce poverty than actually erase poverty. So what happens? We spend billions on programs that address dropouts, seek to reduce substance abuse, divert young people who come into unhappy contact with the law, encourage nutrition, subsidize housing, provide safe houses for the victims of family violence, run the children's aid, realign incentives in the tax system for the working poor, support First Nations education, provide rules-driven, micromanaging welfare programs in every province that invade people's lives, treat poor people as children, and in no circumstance except for one, bring them up beyond the poverty line. That's how we do it, and the bleeding is still there. The core number, at least 10% of our fellow Canadians living under the poverty line, remains unchanged. And all of these programs and all the administration necessary to manage these programs are to deal with the causes of poverty, say the program designers. But in truth, if one steps back and looks at the situation realistically, poverty is not an outcome. Poverty is not a result of a myriad of other forces. Poverty is a core cause of the things that are expensive and not working well and destroying people's lives in our society. There is not enough money in the entire treasury of any country to solve all of family violence, all of illiteracy, physical or mental disadvantage, skill shortages, substance abuse or crime. But we do have enough to solve poverty. We do have that financial capacity. Why are we not doing that? I think it's because of some of the extreme positions on the far right and the far left of Canada's political spectrum. On the far right, topping up poor people's incomes who are of working age violates some primordial angst about paying people to do nothing. How many times have you heard that? Beer and popcorn, somebody once used an expression during a campaign to express that anxiety. Never mind that the vast majority of poor people in this country are working. Some are holding two low-paying jobs, and all don't earn enough from those jobs to actually cover their basic costs. On the left, the narrow bias in the far left favors the design, operation, implementation of special programs for special needs of one form or another by unionized and well-paid civil servants. My grandfather was a union leader. I believe in well-paid civil servants. I believe in public sector unions. They're an important part of who we are. But they are not more important than actually doing away with poverty. We have to find the right balance in that process. In the 1970s, Bill Davis and Darcy McHugh introduced the Guaranteed Annual Income Supplement for senior citizens. It reduced poverty for senior women in Ontario at that point in the cycle from 34% to 3% in 2 years. There was no need for special forms. There was no new bureaucracy. There was no come and see the welfare office and tell us why you need more money for a better diet. None of that happened. You filled out your tax form, you got topped up. Because as Mr. McHugh said when he rose in the legislature of this province, they built this province, they sacrificed for this province, they defended us in peace and war. None of them should be allowed to live in poverty when they reach the age of 65. Period. Full stop. Now, if you think about that principle nationwide, if the federal tax system automatically topped up everyone who is beneath the poverty line through a refundable tax credit or negative income tax or GAI, it's all the same thing, there'd be no one eligible for provincial welfare anywhere in Canada. Their income would be too high. So all the money that goes into provincial welfare could go somewhere else. Early childhood education, home care, a series of important priorities provincial governments say they don't have enough money to actually address these days. Early childhood education, health promotion, and maybe even more physical education and more music in our schools would be affordable if all the people now on welfare had been topped up through the federal system. And you know what? We would change our relationship with the men and women in our society who are poor if we made this automatic and income tested. Here's how our relationship would be different. Those who are the poor amongst us would no longer only be clients or caseload burdens. They would be citizens. They would no longer have to apply through welfare programs and plead through plexiglass for enough money to feed their children. They would no longer be trapped in the rules and constraints of welfare and the odd bits of excessive state involvement in their lives, like the spouse in the house questions, or prohibited from applying for post-secondary education support, which present welfare systems actually make verboten. I.e., they would no longer be trapped in a spider web of welfare rules that is strong enough to entangle, but not really strong enough to support. They would not be treated as intellectually unable to sort through timely and economic choices when afforded the minimum income necessary to do so, but as fellow human beings who would spend money as wisely as anyone else. They would no longer occupy homeless shelters, prisons, courtrooms, mental hospitals in numbers disproportionate to their percentage of the population, because by virtue of their own rational and affordable decisions, they would not be embroiled in the poverty-caused pathologies that fill many of those places. They would file tax returns, as do we all. While currently many of our fellow Canadians who are poor do not, they would have an incentive to do so, as now occurs with the GST tax credit. Their confidentiality and privacy would be protected by law, as it is for all tax filers. And they would be governed by the same rules of honest declaration of income as are we all. In other words, being poor for a few months or years, for whatever reason, would be a problem we all buffered, in the same way as we buffer all Canadians relative to health care. Only a small percentage of Canadians need expensive tertiary health care at any one time. But we are all there as a competitive, free market economy, standing by them when that moment comes, not with strange questions from the state about, well, how come you got sick, and why weren't you thinner, and did you exercise enough, but to get them the treatment they need with their OHIP card at the ready. That's what we do when people get sick. And we know that the largest single predictor of getting sick earlier is being poor. And where are we when it comes to poverty? Oh, lots of terms and conditions, forms to fill out, welfare officers to meet, checking to go on. The things that say we want to institutionalize poverty and not actually eradicate it. In Dauphin, Manitoba, in the mid-1970s, about the time that Bill Davis and Darcy McHugh brought in the Guaranteed Annual Income Supplement for Ontario, the governments of Manitoba and Canada undertook an experiment called MinCom, where residents in this small farming community were assured that if the crop prices failed at the end of the year, they'd be topped up to beyond the poverty line in that jurisdiction. 4,500 families in Dauphin signed up. Here's how it worked. Between 74 and 78 in the town of Dauphin, every resident family was assured top-up should their income fall beneath the poverty line. The guarantee was similar to welfare, but there were no large clawbacks if a person found extra work, and the rules were not onerous. The amount received was theirs with no strings attached. The project assisted, for the most part, the working poor in the community. The entire cost for the multi-year experiment, including all research and staff, was $17 million. The concerns then were the same as are brought up today. If you give someone something for nothing, he or she is going to quit their job, stay home, watch TV, become a burden, as that's the normal human condition. That's what people really want to do with their lives. The answer, to the surprise of some then, I imagine many today, was no. We're only now discovering what went on in Dauphin because the government of Manitoba changed, the government of Canada changed. So no money was invested for 40 years in finding out how the experiment had worked out. The boxes laid full, in an empty warehouse. Fortunately, we have a remarkable academic, University of Manitoba Health Science Center, Dr. Evelyn Forget, who has sorted through the mountain of paper. Through 1,800 boxes of anonymized documents, looking at very deeply at what went right and what went wrong and how it worked. Her research, funded in part by the Canadian Institutes for Health Research under their Social Determinants of Health Research Program, has so far underlined how cost-efficient MinCom was and how the automatic income guarantee in that small community reduced in measurable ways the negative social determinants of health. She has found that in the period that MinCom was administered, hospital visits in the period that MinCom was operating declined by 8.5%. By her calculation, an 8.5% drop in hospital visits in today's health economy would save taxpayers $4 billion annually, for starters. And along with the positive health results, Dr. Forget found that teenagers stayed in school longer, and the education enrollment in Dauphin surged when compared to other parts of Manitoba, because they didn't have to leave because income at home was collapsing because there was a basic guarantee. And we all know, left, right, or center on the political spectrum, the longer people stay in school, the better it is for them, their community, their family, their future, and this country. As her initial report states, and I quote, "The GAI was conceived as an insurance policy. In the same way that people who buy fire insurance on their houses perceive the policy to be beneficial even if they never collect, the GAI benefited everyone in the saturation site, including families that never collected a penny under the scheme. The benefit to those who did collect payments is obvious, but those whose incomes exceeded the threshold, did not qualify, still benefited from the reduction of risk in the community overall. Because this is an agricultural community, few people knew in advance whether they would qualify or not when the end of the fall harvest season rolled around. But the health and social benefits, including the willingness to allow potentially useful adolescent children to stay in school rather than encouraging them to leave early, was a huge benefit for the community and for all of Manitoba. The initial report and its conclusion found that overall hospitalizations, specifically hospitalizations for accidents and injuries, mental health diagnosis declined for MinCom subjects. Physician contacts for mental health diagnosis fell for subjects relative to other parts of the province. During the experimental years, education enrollment was robust. It was noted there was almost no reduction in hours worked, despite the guarantee. The amount of people working hard was not diminished in any way, shape, or form. Some mothers stayed home with very, very young babies, and some stayed home to take care of very, very old family who needed support in the home, all of which is good for the community and constructive for the people involved. Today, the annual cost of such a base refundable tax credit would be probably, depending on the circumstance of the individual, less than $10,000 a year, a little more, a little less. The cost of having a guest of Her Majesty in one of our prisons starts at about $62,000 per year and can be doubled depending on the level of security to $130,000 in a maximum security federal institution. Now, I do not believe that poverty always causes crime. On that basis, my parents would have been hardened criminals, and they weren't. Nor do I believe that those who are poor are more likely to be criminals. Never have and never will. But the fact that most criminals are poor means that 10% of our population fills 90% or more of our jails. And while immigrants who fall beneath the poverty line or First Nations who live in intergenerational poverty do reflect complex contributing factors, ensuring that each lived above the poverty line would be a very good first step. And if that undertaking afforded some protection for First Nations residents from some of the excesses of some band councils, or some immigrants from the attraction of crime gangs in various neighborhoods, that strikes me as an even more appropriate investment to be making. The cost to our Canadian economy of impoverished Canadians dropping out early from school, getting sick faster, staying in hospital longer, and living lives measurably shorter than the rest of us is in the billions of dollars annually. Not to mention what the most important of all of these costs are, the life costs to the Canadians who are living this way through very, very, very difficult life journeys. Police officers have told me when we did our Senate inquiry, they do not get many calls from the better parts of town. So poverty, avoided, evaded, circumnavigated, even exploited, is desperately expensive, well beyond the welfare expenditures themselves. The efficient and humane thing to do in this particular circumstance is to take the example of Dauphin and learn from it. Take the example of the guaranteed income supplement for seniors and apply it. Take the current billions of dollars in welfare, social services, and support costs and redeploy them to solve poverty. While folks have moved in and out of poverty, for too many Canadians, poverty is intergenerational and quasi-permanent. We have tried every manner of incremental solution over the decades, and the evidence is clear. They've not worked. Why not try actually dealing with the issue head-on? Just a radical suggestion to put before you. I have said and written before, it would be hard in any area of public policy to find an approach to ending poverty whose elements were supported by people as radically different as Sir Winston Churchill, Richard Milhouse Nixon, Canada's own Donald S. Macdonald, former MP for Rosedale, and his Royal Commission on Economic Prospects, Milton Friedman from the University of Chicago, the Right Honorable Robert Stanfield, Senator Patrick Moynihan. But a basic income floor or a negative income tax would meet that test. Friedman, the fiscally conservative Nobel-winning economist, had a view of the American government that can best be summarized with one of his most famous quotations, and I quote, "If you put the federal government in charge of the Sahara Desert, in 5 years there'd be a shortage of sand," end of quote. That is why he proposed a negative income tax more than 40 years ago. His belief was that the individual was more able to manage his or her money than well-meaning, hard-working government bureaucracies, and his intention was to create a system that costs less than the welfare system while avoiding the degrading nature of welfare itself. He argued that a negative income tax, which is essentially the same as a refundable tax credit, would be administratively cheaper and more effective. It would remove the intrusive and offensive nanny state over-regulation of the lives of the poor. He was right then. He is no longer with us. He's at that big Department of Economics in the sky, but he is still right now. Education, we would all agree, is a core defining factor in improving future prospects. Yet for those with the will and desire to better themselves through education and better prospects for their children, who are on welfare, those welfare programs marginalize them rather than encourage them. Not only do we dampen their desire, we punish their ambition by clawing back any earnings above a prescribed limit, or cut off welfare if one applies for student loans to go back to school. Imagine that. Or suspend benefits such as dental care or drug benefits for both mother and children if the mother finds full-time employment at minimum wage, effectively creating for that woman trying to work her way out of welfare a 100% tax level for the money she's trying to earn. The wealthiest people in Canada don't have to see 100% on even the highest marginal part of their income. Some parts of Canada welfare departments for young mothers demand a DNA test paid for by the province in order to prove paternity and subsequently claw back any child support received by the young mother by forcing the father, whoever the poor soul is, to pay up. We're spending public funds to do that, rather than actually lift the individuals out of poverty directly. I would argue that it is high time for politicians and policymakers to think more creatively and boldly outside the box that entraps so many. Milton Friedman wanted results on the ground without excessive complexity. Just a few days ago, Francis Lankin, who I admire, former head of Toronto United Way and a former senior minister of health in Ontario, and Munir Sheikh, former chief statistician of Canada, senior fellow at the Queen's School of Policy Studies, released their report, Brighter Prospects: Transforming Social Assistance in Ontario. While neither is a supply-side conservative fiscal proponent, like Friedman, they did say this, and I want to quote it to you. We also heard about the complexity of the current system, its web of benefits, eligibility requirements results in confusion, inconsistency, and excessive administrative burdens, a lack of transparency, and barriers to existing social assistance for work. We heard from caseworkers who would be spending as much as 70% of their time just administering the rules arising from the complex benefit structure. Close quote. This mirrors similar comments made about the need for simplicity by Dr. Hodgson, the senior economist at the Conference Board of Canada back in December of 2011. The Lankin-Munir-Sheikh report has much to commend it, especially around admissible asset levels for welfare applicants and the need for universal income guarantee for the handicapped. But I believe we must move beyond tinkering with the present system and take a completely new approach if we're actually going to achieve our goal. According to the May 2010 Statistics Canada research, 14% of Canadian young people 15 to 24 are unemployed, and this number has not changed in several years. That is just under double the national rate of unemployment, and partially explains why more young people are counted now than ever before among the poor. First Nations people living on reserves face an unemployment rate of nearly 25% and almost 14% when living off reserves. And as for new immigrants to Canada who traditionally in the past used to do better, those with university degrees face an unemployment rate of 14.3%, and those with the equivalent of a high school diploma are unemployed at a 17% rate. Setting aside some of the structural and related inequities in this mix, we need to be frank with ourselves about what unemployment rates that high for these groups do for them, for their families, for the rest of society, for Canada itself in terms of stability, incentive, and opportunity over the next decades. Let's look at costs here in a realistic way. If the average top-up per person now living beneath the poverty line was between $5,000 and $10,000 annually, and if all of the 3 million of these people received the amount spread over four quarters, this would be an upfront cost of $15 to $30 billion, roughly 5 to 10% of the present Canadian federal budget. But to get a real accounting of costs and benefits, we'd have to subtract the cost of provincial welfare, which is supported by federal transfers, federal tax dollars, and provincial tax dollars, because those topped up would no longer, as I said earlier, be eligible. Then we could subtract some of the provincial and federal administrative costs as other income security programs for the working age population became unnecessary. Employment insurance could go back to being employment insurance, and not a mix between employment insurance, regional development, income security, and doing none of those three tasks particularly well. Next, we should take the figures from the MINCOM study of Dr. Forge and see what happens when health expenditure pressures are reduced by 8%. And with the knowledge we have relating to poverty and crime, subtract 5% to be conservative, the costs of our prisons, criminal court system, aspects of child welfare. We might not break even in the first year of a refundable tax credit, but it could be phased in over a period of time. But we would break even over a period of years. And as the rate of poverty fell, we would begin to experience reduction of the pressures on healthcare costs, prison costs, and other social services. This relief would come just at the point when demographic pressures are becoming more demanding as our society ages. Having less people living beneath the poverty line would expand both the economic and social mainstream and the circle of opportunity for all Canadians. Now let's talk about the numbers I just referred to. During the 08-09 financial collapse led by the failure of the Lehman Brothers Bank, something for which you actually can't blame poor people, although somebody I'm sure will try, Central Mortgage and Housing in Canada, a crown corporation dependent ultimately on the Canadian taxpayer, found several hundred billion dollars, $362 billion actually, to buy perfectly solid mortgages from our banks in Canada to guarantee them the cash flow necessary to keep credit and business and lending moving. Between banks, for Bay Street, for auto loans, and the rest as the global credit system was drying up at that time, I think that was a good decision. I don't disagree with it. But if we can, as a public policy priority, provide liquidity for the largest and most profitable parts of our economy, why is it so awful to provide a little bit of cash flow for people at the lower end, to give them some of the capacity to manage through difficult times in a similar way? You know, living in poverty usually does not make possible a focused savings program or an investment plan. Income received is spent on food and clothing and heat and shelter and transportation, on one's children or grandchildren. In other words, it recirculates instantly in the economy, strengthening the economy and the community. When Newfoundland and Labrador, under Premier Danny Williams, lifted the welfare support level for single recipients to above the poverty line for the first time in Canadian history, Premier Williams made it very clear that if higher resource revenues were becoming a structural part of his province's fiscal base, deploying them for the neediest amongst residents of Newfoundland and Labrador was simply the right thing to do. I think his progressive conservative response to wealth creation and equality of opportunity should encourage all of us to ask ourselves about the purpose of wealth and its generation in a free and mixed market democracy like Canada. We know what poverty is. It is not having enough money to meet modest requirements, housing, food, heat, clothing, and transportation. It's the marginalization of kids who claim to have forgotten their lunch at home when there was no lunch packed to begin with. In the little city of Kingston, 110,000 people, we give out 3,000 free breakfasts a day in schools where we know the kids would get no breakfast any other way. Poverty is marriages that are abusive and soul-destroying, staying together only because there is no way for the abused partner to leave and stand on their own 2 feet. It's about high school kids drawn to substance abuse and local gangs because there is no way they can make it to college or even to the end of high school. The gangs and all that go with them offer a better present and more plausible future than living in a welfare home. When Don Drummond released his report on Ontario spending, February of this year, he analyzed and made recommendations in many areas of public policy and public spending. But several of his observations are worth reflecting on briefly tonight. He noted that the nearly one quarter of recent immigrants, 28.8% in Ontario, lived in poverty 5 years after arrival, and 19% continued to live in poverty after 10 years. About 22% of severely disabled Canadians receive social assistance and have no ties whatever to the labor force. The report states that these people, and I quote, would be better served by a national basic income program instead of social assistance, close quote. His report questions the Ontario Works cap on recipients' liquid assets, which currently stands at $1,600 for a single parent, and points out that this deprives recipients of the most basic means of climbing the welfare wall. So in a welfare family, a welfare mom, the son finds a job busing tables at Swiss Chalet, begins to save a little money for college. Welfare system says, can't have that money saved for that. Sorry, we're going to have to cut off your monthly payments. This is progress. This is using the capacity of our system to give people a better chance. This is frustrating the very young people and mothers who are trying, by and large, to do the right thing. He had a couple of other recommendations. Called for advocating for federal reforms in key areas. Work with other provinces and the federal government to establish a national income support program for people with disabilities. He said, don't simply cut costs. The imperative to restrain spending should instead be an opportunity to reform programs and service delivery. It's not about more money the same way. It's about doing things completely differently. Governments do not do everything well. Anyone who thinks so has never worked within government. But one thing governments have learned to do well is collect taxes from all who should be paying taxes. They know how to deduct taxes at source for the vast majority of us who make a living by earning a salary. And because they have done this for years, they have the confidential records of how much we earn and how much legitimate costs we have, which means that we have a delivery system in place tied to every taxpayer or tax credit collector, including the folks who receive GST tax credits and other refundable tax credits in the system. This means that credit is paid out automatically to anyone whose tax form declaration of income makes them automatically eligible. No need to recreate the wheel. No need to build and design a new bureaucracy or new forms to fill out. We have the system in place to do this, and the cost of it would be offset by the reduction in the most expensive costs of the pathologies that poverty continues to feed every day. I believe, friends, that there are two parts to national security. One part is our ability to defend our borders, the rule of law, democracy, human rights, and freedom for our fellow Canadians as part of their citizens' legitimate expectation. This involves a mix of freedoms and responsibilities we defend and share at home, and sometimes at very great cost, as we all recalled yesterday, abroad. The other part of national security relates to the economic security of our fellow Canadians. That security is sustained by different Canadian traditions. Universal health insurance available to all residents. Universal primary and secondary education available to all residents. A basic income floor for our seniors, which we have had for almost 40 years. But the economic security base, so fundamental to encouraging achievement and economic growth, the pursuit of excellence and a stronger and more inclusive economy open to all, is deeply flawed, weakened, and even imperiled if a basic income floor that eradicates poverty is not part of it. Letting poverty fester when we have the capacity and wherewithal to address it head on is more than the abdication of opportunity. It is a politically irresponsible evasion of our collective responsibility. It is one thing to be unable to broaden the economic mainstream because of financial or productivity problems. That happens from time to time. It is quite another to leave people behind who do not need to be left behind and for whom a structural hand up would remove the need for a less than effective handout process that goes on in perpetuity, inefficiently, and with great cruelty. Not dealing with poverty is like saying a serious, curable disease affecting millions of our fellow Canadians is not worth addressing. For every Canadian, for shareholders and private sector and union leaders, for every business leader sitting on a hospital board, for every minister from any party at either the provincial or federal level, for any policy wonk working around the poverty question but not dealing with it directly, the burden here of the sin of omission cannot be diminished. Dealing with poverty, reducing its occurrence to almost incidental single digits, should be the social project of our time, the projet de société for this new Canadian century. Energy superpower? Super. Strong global voice for the rule of law, democracy, gender equity, freer trade, international security? Great. Supporter of law and order at home, more high-value scientific research? Excellent. But without engaging on poverty in a direct and focused way, none of these will matter as the gaps between the richest and the poorest expand and the economic order means less opportunity for low-income Canadians as opposed to more. Let's remind ourselves who the poor are. They mostly work. Many are young and of working age. Many have disabilities. Most have grown up in a poverty not of their making. Many are among our First Nations and are increasingly among our young people and our lawful immigrants. They are in every large city and small community and in the very large Canadian spaces between communities. And they are in the beginning and in the end, our brothers and our sisters, our neighbors and our fellow citizens. For many Canadians, a fall from their present lives into poverty could take just one event: a car accident, a failed employer, a lost job, a serious illness. A basic income floor, a refundable anti-poverty income tax credit, would put a floor under all Canadians beneath which they could not fall, a floor that would see them through to working and earning again, which is what they want to do. Putting limits on what one can achieve is not what any state should do. Churchill said, "I am opposed to limiting how high people can reach, but there must be a balustrade against which everyone can lean when they have no other choice." Limiting what people can achieve would be overreach by the state and excessive. But putting a floor under which no one can fall is the least we can do. It is affordable. It is manageable. It is sustainable and will pay all of society higher returns than our present all help short of real aid approach that leaves poverty for the next generation to solve. We can absolutely do better, and I stand before you tonight with a simple proposition that we have a moral duty to at least try. Thank you very much.
There's one part, the First Nations people, that presents its own unique set of problems. If I remember rightly, there are roughly 600 nation communities in Canada, roughly 1.3 million people. And like other British colonies, such as the United States, Australia, and New Zealand, all of are coping with the problems. So Jean Chrétien talked about dissolution of the Indian Act. Stephen Harper has brought it up. How do we get around the hurdles of First Nations people to address the problems you have approached tonight?
Thank you very much for that question. I think we are at a rare window of opportunity because of, if I may say so, the leadership, engagement, and intensity of Sean Atleo, the new chief of the AFN. He is one of the first Native leaders in this country, First Nations leaders, to take the position that doing away with the Indian Act would be a very good first step. The challenge, of course, is to structure a process by which the trusteeship under which First Nations lands and interests are addressed under that act is replaced by something more appropriate and more reflective of First Nations rights to govern themselves, a constitutional provision we now have in terms of that inalienable right for our First Nations brothers and sisters. Let me tell you how what I said tonight, I think, connects with your very thoughtful question. If you do an analysis of many of the problems on the First Nations reserves that have had serious issues, I'm not talking about the ones that are doing well and are working well and have a resource base, but the others, part of the challenge has always been the fact that the federal government flows the money to the Band Council. The Band Council then spends it the way it sort of wants to. Some do a very good job, as is the case in any governance process, some not so much. Part of what I'm saying is that if we applied the principle I'm talking about to flowing the basic income level to the First Nation individuals, not to the Band Councils, to the people who live in the communities, they would be like any other set of taxpayers. If they're upset with City Council, well, they're the ones who pay the taxes. They're the ones who have the right to fight back. And I believe there's a way to respect First Nation sovereignty, to respect the role of the chiefs, both the inherited and the elected, and to change the funding mechanism so more of it goes to the actual First Nations families, households, so they can have more freedom and greater impact on their own community. I don't for a moment think it would be easy, but if we had a commitment to a basic income floor for all Canadians, that would be a very constructive way to begin the discussions with Chief Atleo about a more constructive devolution than perhaps is now the case as we sit here tonight.
This always seems to be like the idea of the future, and I'm just wondering why this basic idea for a basic income is never the policy of the present.
I would say that there are three perpetual forces in opposition which are very strong and work whatever the government's affiliation is. NDP government, Liberal government, Conservative, Progressive Conservative, but whatever the title is, Parti Québécois. Basically, you have a core group of civil servants, and by the way, they mean well. This is not some pernicious effort on their part, who say if you establish this automatic right for a percentage of the population, your budget's going to be smaller, Minister. You're going to have less choices to make, less programs to design, and therefore your authority, your sovereignty, your importance will be reduced. We don't like to do that as public servants. Our job as public servants is to maximize your areas of discretion, the choices you could make. That's our job as public servants. And I think that that mindset amongst public servants, unless there's political leadership, is the same under any administration of any affiliation. Every department of finance in the world puts out estimates every year that overstates the costs and understates the revenues. Why? So the Minister of Finance can have maximum control in keeping spending from happening. And then you wake up and you say, oh, look, they cut a whole bunch of billions nobody knew about. We missed the meeting. That's because finance departments work to make that happen, because they know if the minister ends up with a little more money, a little less debt, he or she is a happy minister. So that's one force. The other force, if I may say so, and I say this with the greatest of respect, there is a lot of people. I'll give you one story that was told when we, our committee, Senator Eggleton's committee and mine, we were in Nova Scotia, and a very decent, wonderful community worker appeared before us. And she said, you know, I have for years worked in a church group that meets before Christmas. We put together lovely baskets with turkeys and cake and all the other things. We distributed to the most needy families in the community. And she said, I went to a meeting and I thought about it and I asked this question. What if we just gave the families the money? They could decide what they wanted in their own Christmas basket. Everybody was horrified. They're going to decide for themselves what should be in a Christmas basket. That's our job. And we do it with a great sense of Christian charity. So there's a little bit of that around. The swells know, you know, the welfare officers know better. And by the way, everybody is well-meaning. This is not about any kind of pernicious, nasty. These are people who, but there is a view that poor people can't be trusted to make rational decisions. Prince William is the honorary patron of a charity in the big cities of the UK. I think it's called Panorama, and it's about basically men, mostly men, who sleep on the street. And one of the recommendations that emerged from that process was, why don't we offer these people a lump sum of money and see what they would do with it? I think it was £700, not the end of the world. 85% went, we would call them trailers, they call them caravans. 85% wanted to rent a caravan that plugged in, that had heating and water and a toilet. Others wanted to spend the money on a warm room, better food, warm clothes. Was there 15% who preferred to spend the money on booze and drugs and tobacco? Of course. But if we're talking about gaming the system, anybody want to talk about our friends at the Lehman Bank? Why do we have one set of rules for those who game the system at one level, but we really come down hard on those people who at the low income level, you know, even though they're in the minority? So all the evidence that we see is that when low income people are given the chance to make rational choices with a modest amount of money, they will make rational choices. I think many of us don't believe that. In fact, there was a Sally Ann poll came out a few months ago that said the vast majority of Canadians thought poor people were lazy, poor people couldn't be trusted with money, poor people could, you know, a family of four could get by on $20,000 a year, not a problem. You know, and these aren't, by the way, these aren't mean people. The truth is we have bigotry about poor people in our society. And the problem, of course, on the other end is that poor people don't vote. They don't show up in droves to support the political party or candidate of their choice because they're busy surviving. They're busy dealing with the last call from the collection agency or the cutting off of the heat. That's what their problem is. And not only do they not vote, but the people who live on the streets spend almost all their time, we found out at the Calgary Homeless Foundation, where they're eradicating homelessness, in a foundation that's led by private sector people and the church and the police and others. And they've defined what homelessness is. Getting rid of homelessness means no one stays in a shelter for more than 7 days before they get a permanent place to live. And on that basis, they are in fact engaged in a core premise of respecting the rights of poor people and treating them as citizens. So until we get beyond those barriers, it's going to be hard to get the kind of leadership we need.
October 24 and 25, we released in the region of Peel, the affordable housing strategy and the poverty reduction strategy, the vision of which is a livable future for all, and the path of which is from poverty to possibility. At our table, we talk about what it means to have prosperity. So for prosperity, you have to have location, you have to have connection, and then you have partnership. And I'm wondering if you could help us find a way for the federal government to have a national policy on location, which would be affordable housing, on connection, which would be bandwidth and transportation infrastructure, and also for public education, under which is the thing that raises the bar and accessibility to post-secondary education.
Well, let me say that and this is my view generally of how the country operates, regardless of who's in power in Ottawa or in the provinces, most of the changes that have really made a huge difference in people's lives in this country have come from provincial governments. Tommy Douglas was a provincial politician. That's where health care came from, because it's easier to do that in one jurisdiction than to find a multifaceted balance across the country. As you will know, the federal government announced anything beyond its normal range of activities, as would be the case if they stayed within the national tax system, Quebec would go up like a rocket, maybe Alberta, maybe some other provinces, saying that's actually none of your business. Just give us the money, we'll do it. So the risk you face, of course, is that large amounts of money are allocated, but what actually happens with the money in the provinces isn't what you and I would like to see transpire. Paul Martin, for reasons I think he regretted, had to cut back the funding for social housing when he was the Minister of Finance during difficult fiscal times. Mr. Flaherty was able to re-put some of that money back, not enough, but he put back $1.9 billion in the first year the government came back. So I think the spirit of wanting to be constructive is there, but I truly believe that it's from the provinces that these kinds of specific changes could come. And part of what I would hope for, my aspiration would be that the federal and provincial governments would embark on a series of real large pilot projects around the Dauphin experiment. And the incentive to the provinces would be, if you come with us in this, you could save hundreds of millions in welfare dollars because your people will be topped up. And that would give you more money to spend on precisely the priorities that you referenced in your question. And I would like to see a federal government that was prepared to have that discussion and embrace it. I can't tell you that's where we are today. I'd be misrepresenting where we are, but hope springs eternal.
I'm wondering if you can reflect. We talked about the Aboriginal communities and the idea that trying to give income to that community may or may not have much resonance in perhaps the current government. But if you link it to the proposition with energy infrastructure development, the issues that we face today, and the idea that they become partners, that the Aboriginal communities become partners in this infrastructure development, that could unlock the difficulties we have around that. And when they become partners, that income flows back to the community, to individuals, to meet the kind of proposition you're putting forward. May or may not have some resonance, if you can reflect on that.
I will, and let me say this. In that question, you are touching a very important stream of those parts of our national history where negotiations with First Nations have actually been productive for both sides. Great Whale in Quebec, Bourassa, other undertakings under the Levesque administration were all based essentially on saying to First Nations, the Cree in that circumstance, come be a partner. We will respect your land rights. We will ensure a payment structure, a royalty structure for you and your children. This is the same thing that goes on in the Western Arctic with Nellie Kernwaye in her area, where when that land agreement was signed by Prime Minister Mulroney and the Inuvialuit, those basic resources and the revenue therefrom became part of the Inuvialuit legacy, a large legacy fund which is professionally administered, providing scholarships for Inuvialuit kids, infrastructure for the community, so they're not being left behind as that economy grows. We are not, in my judgment, going to get through what we need to sort out in Western Canada with respect to access to natural resources unless we bring First Nations to the table as partners. You know, Ted Newell, who just passed away, who was one of the great movers in the oil sands, started out very early by saying, let me be clear to all his senior managers, if a fixed percentage as a bare minimum of the contracting done in these mining operations is not in the hands of First Nations, we have failed, you have failed. It will reflect on how you're recompensed in this organization. And don't tell me they don't know how to do it. It's our job to put together joint training programs so they can. And it's been one of the great quiet successes. So your principle is correct. And when I say we're at a moment of opportunity, the mix of the need to address accountability, First Nations, finances, and all those issues, Chief Atlio wanting something other than the Indian Act to apply, Canada looking for a way to advance our resource interest on a global basis so as to create greater Canadian wealth, social opportunity, is a tremendous window of opportunity. And we could, I think, put our heads together and find a way to make it go forward in a fashion that would reflect the very thoughtful proposition you advanced. As you know, senators don't get to make these decisions by themselves. I am not in the federal cabinet, so I can have views and I can advance them, but I'm unable to hold out any promise to you that I can deliver on them, to be brutally frank. Thank you.
You have been listening to a TVO podcast. Support Ontario's public television. Donate at tvo.org. TVO makes you think.